Hey, what up? Welcome down to the Tony Lowry Podcast. Thank you for tuning in once again. In the first episode, if you missed it, I was just giving a little backstory on who I am and introducing myself a little bit. So that way you can kind of get comfortable with me. I think it's just better to kind of have that rapport first than to just jump in a, you know, giving you feedback and a whole bunch of outlook advice and stuff like that. And you don't really know anything about me. So just kind of giving you a little bit of my backstory. So this is a bio series of who I am as an artist, and then we'll evolve into the training side of who I am as a fitness trainer. That way you kind of have a little familiarity with who you're talking to, all right? So I hope you enjoy it. Sit back and relax, and I'll continue these stories for you a little bit. This is the Tony Lowry Podcast. Welcome in. Okay, before I go too far, I want to do one thing that I didn't get to cover in the last episode. When it comes to my Just Boys crew, I know I didn't get to shout at everybody because it was kind of spur of the moment, so I didn't get to get those names. So let me give you the exact names of that crew. So you have myself, me, Tony Lowry, and then you have my friend Hagen Randolph. Derek Haynes, of course, was one. But we have Mark Claiborne. We have Barry Newborn. We have Frank McQuay. We have Lamont Austin. We have my boy Terrell Claiborne. We had Roderick Claiborne or Bo Claiborne and Clarence. There's a bunch of others, but the core members were those people that I just mentioned. And though we had people that kind of interchanged in and out, the name stayed the same, the Just Boys crew. We did some great things. As I was saying in the last episode, we were part of some pretty good shows and tours and stuff like that. And one of the ones I touched on, which was the Eazy-E NWA tour, which happened in 1989. Which is a little fast forwarding past the timeline of things that I want to share with you. But that was a great experience because that was a night at Western Illinois University where DOC, the artist DOC, hip hop legend DOC, was debuted. They had just signed him to Ruthless Records, and we got the honor of seeing him perform for the first time that evening. And it was just a sick performance. It was crazy. So you've already got NWA killing it. You know, Ice Cube in his prime, Silver Raiders jacket, Jerry Curl hanging, Eazy-E. I mean, you know, all the nostalgia. Dr. Dre on the tables with DJ Yella. And then out of nowhere, on top of like four speakers, they shine a spotlight. And there's this tall dude with Loke glasses on and a King's hat with an incredible bellowing voice. And this dude is DOC, Dallas, Texas's finest. And oh, man. You all know the history of the guy, man. This guy dropped Funky Enough for the first time in our face, and we lost it. We lost it. So as young kids, we were like, I think I was like 16, going on 17 at the time. I was actually 17 at the time. And it was crazy. I mean, we got to kick it with NWA that night. We had a great time with them. It was just funny. Ice Cube is hilarious. I mean, this is young Ice Cube, so he really didn't give a F. He didn't really give a F at all. I mean, He was just funny. He was just straight, just bold. But you had to love it. It was everything that you expected from a dude. But great crew, great guys, man. They was really super humble and chilled out dudes, which was crazy for them to be NWA and as scary as their image was at the time. They were super cool dudes backstage, man. Very brotherly. Very cool, man. And I remember having a swift engagement with Eazy-E, exchange with him. And the brother was just chill, man. Cool dude, man. Sense of humor. I mean, just funny guy, man. Just so rest in peace. You know, Uncle Eazy-E, man. That's love, man, from way back then. But let's go back. My crew, like I said, we were opening up shows and stuff. And in the course of doing this, in the summers, I used to go to Flint, Michigan, stay with my aunt, Joanne, and my grandmother's sister. And I went. That was before all of this hoopla and all this happened with my crew. I think I was about like 14 when I went to my first concert. And the first concert I was able to go to, my aunt gave me kind of a sneaky pass to go by myself. And I went to the Detroit Pontiac Center where the Pistons play. And I got to see the Fresh Fest. It was actually the Fresh Fest 2. This is the second round because they did it the first year and I didn't get to go, of course. I lived in Davenport. Nobody comes to Davenport. But the second time I was in Michigan when it came around and I was able to get tickets and go. Now, this is a crazy show. And if anybody of age knows about the Fresh Fest, your nostalgia right now is got to be going overload because you know what I'm talking about. So you have Run DMC in their prime, Houdini, UTFO, The Real Roxanne, Fat Boys. You had Oh my gosh. I mean, you could just go on for days. And I'm only sharing this story because this is a pivotal moment for me as a young man at 14, because this is what really made me take the hip hop culture seriously. This night alone. Because at this time I was a break dancer. I go into this arena by myself wearing one of those little glow in the dark necklaces that you can buy there in a concert. And this whole arena was just dark, right? So I'm on the floor, young kid, and some kind of way I maneuvered my ass all the way up to the front. I was just on the standing room only part of the floor, but I got all the way, I weaved until I got all the way to the front where I could just see their face and everything. And the thing that changed me, there was a great show that night. Houdini murdered it. Fat Boys killed it. It was just classic night all the way around. Everybody's set was dope. Run DMC was the headliners. And this was profound. I'd never seen Run DMC in person. I'd only seen them on MTV. They were still in their prime. I mean, it was like seeing Michael Jackson in his prime. You know what I'm saying? So in hip hop terms. So got to see, you know, Run and D and J do their thing in their prime in the Pontiac. And what was so cold about that particular night was Run did something that I just had never seen before. So let's give you the Run DMC show as they come out, right? Just real briefly. So Jam Master J comes from the ceiling on some kind of a scaffold thing they had him on. And they lowering him down with GMJ on the front of the banner on his tables. And he's scratching. Jam Master J. Jam Master J. Cutting it. I mean, anybody knows classic Run DMC, you know how Jam Master J. So headphones on the side, he killing it. And I'm this close where I can see all of this like super crispy, right? It's crazy. So he comes down, boom. Then after he gets done scratching Jam Master J, then he starts cutting DMC, DMC. And then DMC walks out of the stage, takes like three or four steps out onto the stage, crosses his arms, and just stares at everybody. He doesn't say a damn word. He doesn't say shit. So I'm like, ah! I mean, the way they did this show built so much hype. It was crazy. And these guys hadn't even went into a song yet. This took like 5-10 minutes for them to happen. Then everybody's going crazy. DMC just standing there, right? Then Run starts talking from the behind the stage. Like, he's talking from behind the stage because he knew he was the superstar. He knew everybody wanted to see him at that time. And Run starts talking and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. He's like, yo, what's my name? And he started cutting, Run, Run, Rick, Run. Now, anybody who knows hip-hop, that Run was the most popular thing you could scratch in that time period. It was just the most popular thing you could scratch. So when he started scratching the run, then he just walks out all aerially, just swagging on stage like whatever. Black leather jacket with an Adidas suit on it underneath, hat popped to the side. And he steps out on the front of stage, Adidas with no laces in them. It was so gangster, it was crazy. You just had to be in this moment. I'm sitting here just soaking this up as a kid, like, what the fuck is this? Run steps to the front of the stage. Everybody gets quiet. He puts his hands like, you know, he does the little things where he like tell everybody simmer down. So everybody gets quiet. He says his famous line. We've had a lot of superstars on this stage here tonight, but I want y'all to know one MFing thing. This is my MFing house. When he said that, the whole arena went ballistic. Like, ah, right? So they go into It's Like That. So, you know, DJ Run's my name. Jam Master J is his. It's DMC, it's like that. And that's the way it is. That was their famous show opening. Boom. I'm losing it. I'm in the crowd losing it. Like, oh my God, what is, I ain't never seen this before. Damn. No dancers, no nothing. This is just all him talking. What? So I'm just blown. So midway through the set, Run says, yo, bring the house lights up. So then everybody is like kind of on exposed. Now he brought the house lights up. You see all these people. Then he says, how many people in here is wearing Adidas tonight? If you're wearing Adidas, take one shoe off and hold it in the air. Wow. Everybody that had on Adidas in that arena pulled off one shoe, held it in the air. He said, pan the lights around. They panned around, bro. And you could see shoes, like a sea of shoes all around the arena. Now, my dumb ass is wearing Nikes. I'm a Nike man. Okay, sue me. But I was wearing Nikes at that time, and I felt so little. I'm like, damn. I didn't, okay, damn. Okay, that's cool. But yeah, it was crazy. He had everybody literally pull off one shoe. And the power of that move, of him doing that, ended up resulting in them having a shoe endorsement from Adidas. True story. So after that night going home, this concert was crazy. So they killed it. After going home that night, that moment stuck with me. I was like, this dude made people pull off one shoe. Like, I was telling everybody. I was telling my auntie, everybody. He made everybody pull off one shoe. It was crazy. You had to see it. I just kept thinking about that. I was like, damn, that's some power. Like a big dog. Just because he said to do it, they did it. And I was hooked. I was like, okay, I want to do that. I want to be a rapper. I want to be an MC. I'm not just a rapper. I want to be an MC. I want to be able to control the crowd. Master of ceremonies. I don't want to just get up there and you hear me rap. I want to be able to, when I say do this, y'all do this. When I say move that way, y'all move that way. That's beautiful. It's like, it's beautiful sharing that kind of energy. So, Before I go any further, I just wanted to share that that's a pivotal moment. And you have these pivotal moments that kind of give you a glimpse at what you could probably be in the future. And that was mine. I was like, whoa, I like that. I like that. And that really made me like take the craft seriously. Start to study how to write better. I even took my appearance better. I was like, damn, well, you know, what do I look like? You know, and I was trying my best to look like whoever I saw that kind of looked like me. So I saw LL Cool J. I was like, ah, that's the guy. Hey, I want to look like that. So I was trying to, you know, emulate LL Cool J as much as I possibly could. Still one of my heroes to this day. But it was a very pivotal moment that made me go, damn, wow. And I was really glad to have that experience. So you always have to have something that sparks you. You always have to have something that gives you that, whoa, that kind of like opens your nose a little bit to the possibilities of what you could be and what could be possibly in your future, depending on how you apply yourself. So I just wanted to share that pivotal story about myself, just so you kind of have an understanding of what it was that kind of drew me to the craft of hip hop. It wasn't money. It was not money. It wasn't girls. It wasn't about none of that. I didn't see any of that. What I saw was somebody being able to take his energy and share it with hundreds of people and get a response. And that to me was powerful. Hold tight. I'll be right back with some more stories for you. This is the Tony Lowry Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. So I want to fast forward a little bit because I don't want to stay too much on my hip hop background. So that way we can get through this bio a little quickly. But I just wanted to share some of these very small parts about my background so you kind of have an understand what it was that attracted me to be an MC, an artist first, and then what attracted me to the culture, and then what made me want to pursue it, of course, as a career. That's the reason why I'm giving you these portions of this backstory. And I'll give you a little bit more about my fitness. I'm going to give you a lot about my fitness as well, but I just wanted to start on the musical side because that's where I began. Jumping back into my crew, after doing all of these shows and doing all this and building up the crew's name, we did all this. When I got to my senior year of high school, that was another pivotal point for me. My crew was very popular now. We're like a baby new addition in the area. You know, it was crazy. We would go to the mall. We would see people. It was dope. It wasn't like we had people chasing us or nothing like that. But I mean, we were just very well known. We were already well known around the town anyway. But once we became a crew, then we were well known for that. So at this point, everybody knows me for being a dancer and all this jazz. It's my senior year of high school. At that time, I was trying to decide what I wanted to do after I got out of high school. So I was like, what do I want to do? I ran track and athletics. That was a big thing of mine always in school, athletics and track. And I had a plan to go to Clark Atlanta University. I really wanted to go to a HBSC, a historically black college, and graduate maybe as a fraternity. You know, I wanted to go that route. I was heavily influenced by like shows like, you know, Cosby Show and Different World that really influenced me as a black male to go, whoa, I need to really consider college. So I, you know, regardless of what anybody says about Dr. Cosby, I really thank him for that influence, because had it not really been for those shows in our area, we had people that would go away to college. But for our small area, it didn't seem that realistic that you could go away to a big college unless you had money like that. But just watching shows like that kind of gave you that different possibility. So I just wanted to touch on that real quick. But senior year of high school, I started looking more towards the future. Like, what am I going to do after I get out of high school? one of the first times that I had a good battle was in high school. So it was my sophomore year. Now I'm gonna go back to senior year in a second. But in sophomore year, this was the first time I had a battle. This was funny. So my friend Derek, like I said, was one of my Ace Boom Coons. We used to run around all the time. We had this kid that was from, he had moved in from out of town. And I forgot where he was from. I want to say he was from the East Coast somewhere. And he claimed to be really good at rapping and all of this. And he was a little arrogant about it. And so my friend Derek, being the antagonist that he was, boosted this kid into thinking that I wanted to battle him. So he was like, yo, I bet you can't beat Tone. I bet you can't bring that to Tone. And it was like, what? So lunchtime came. I wasn't even knowing. Lunchtime came. We all sitting in the little square where we all kind of chilled and da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, we started rapping for fun. Me and my boy, Corey Parker at the time, who was my DJ, but beatbox at the time. He was my beatbox because you always needed a beatbox at that time. If you wanted to rap, you didn't have beats. You needed somebody who could bust a cold beat. Well, my boy, Corey Parker, was the master of beatbox at that time. I'm telling you, he really was. He's a reverend now, which is hilarious. Shout out, Rev Parker. But he was the master of beatboxing at that time. My man, Corey Parker. So my man, CP, busted a beat. We sitting there rhyming. This kid jumps in and he starts kicking his raps and stuff like that. Da 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 da. Well, in the middle of that, my boy goes, why don't you battle Tone? He really antagonizes this battle. You know, my boy was good for that kind of shit. And I don't know, whatever, man. I wasn't even tripping on the thing, but you know, your boy goes, all right, what's up? So he comes at me and he starts rhyming and he starts clowning me pretty much, and I didn't even really want to battle this dude. He started talking all about me and stuff and made people start laughing. So all my friends are sitting there laughing at me. I'm like, what the fuck? But in my mind, the funny part was Derek knew I could rap, and a lot of my other friends didn't even know I could really rap like that. They knew I could rap a little, but they didn't really know I could go in, especially not on the freestyle off the head. So this guy started coming at me, and Derek knew me well enough to know that once this dude started coming at me, it was going to build my adrenaline and make me rise to the occasion. And sure enough, as soon as this dude started insulting me enough, I was like, okay, all right, I got in game face mode. So as soon as he got done, I was like, I think I asked him that. I was like, are you done? And when he got done, I must have just clowned his life. I talked about his rap. I talked about his hair, everything about him. And it was just funny, man. I took all those laughs and turned them back to him tenfold, where everybody was just like, stop. Like, my boy was pulling me away and I was still rapping like, what? You know what I'm saying? Like, so when I got that thirst of the battle, after winning that first battle, being in my first battle and then winning it, I was like, oh yeah, I got to stay ready. I don't want nobody ever think that they can humiliate me on the spot like that, because I wasn't even ready that day, honestly. I just actually had the power of freestyle in my grasp, so I was lucky. But I was like, nah, I don't ever want to get caught off guard like that again. So that's what made me take the element of freestyle very important, and that's why I wanted to share that story as far as my hip-hop history. That's what attracted me to the freestyle element and the competition in that sense, that, well, you know, instead of saying that you're better than another dude, put your money where your mouth is. Be able to back it up, right? Be able to back it up with your lyrics. Not back it up with beating somebody's ass. I mean, that's easy. Yeah, okay, that's just gang shit. But no, keep it in the culture. Beat somebody with your thoughts. Beat them with your lyrics. Beat them with your words. Use your words. So that's something that I became very good at. So now fast forward back to senior year. Senior year now, I'm rapping a lot better. Me and my dance crew are very popular. We actually got noticed by a big show at the time called Star Search. And we were to audition and go on Star Search so that way we could actually get an opportunity to perform and compete and all of that. The only problem was, is going back to what I told you in that first episode, was my strict grandfather. Me being one of the pillar members of the crew, I was not allowed to go to the Star Search competition. Very heartbreaking for me. That really kind of crushed my spirit, because I'd done all this groundwork. That's why I wanted to give you the backstory. I'd done all this groundwork to this point. Senior year, me and my crew's popular. We get this opportunity to get in the industry and get recognized, and I can't even participate, strictly just because my grandfather didn't understand and didn't want me to be involved. So after that made me go, okay, that's why I'm saying this was a pivotal point for me. That made me get a plan of what I wanted to do after high school. I knew I wanted to pursue music. I had already had that attraction. I believed highly in myself and my skill set and the person that I was and all of that. So it was no question for me that after senior year, I was going for it. My mother lived here in California at the time. And we used to communicate through letters and all this different jazz. And there's a long story why I was staying with my grandparents. You know, my mother moved away. There's a long story behind that. We'll share that another time. But my mother was in California, and I knew, I was like, well, I could go to Atlanta, as I was telling you guys, or I could go to California, where my mother is. What shall I do? And at that time, I was kind of like, well, I want to go to Clark. Yeah, I want to go down there. But I didn't have relatives that I knew of at that time. So my mom was in California. That made it a more of an easier choice for me. I'm going to go to California. So after high school, boom, I had saved my money. Maybe it was like 200, 300 bucks for my little Foot Locker job. My mom came. We bounced out. We went to California, rolling in our Cadillac. Real talk. 2 day rolling in the Cadillac. And upon getting here in California, it was like a real culture shock for me. Totally different. Bigger, wider, more dimensional. A lot of different people. Way more diverse. And for the first few months, I really didn't do a lot. After the first few months of me just working and kind of coming home and all of that, I met some friends in the mall where I was working at Lakewood Mall. People know Lakewood Mall here in Lakewood, California, whatever. I met some friends, my friend Clint Francis and my other friend Jermaine. And these guys worked in a place across from me. I was working at this place called Jeans West, if anybody remembers that. My first job I got was an assistant manager job at Jeans West in the mall. And right across from the mall, there was this place where you could record your own song, if anybody remembers those. And my boy Jermaine and Clint were the guys who worked there. So on my lunch breaks, I would just go over there and want to go in one of the rooms, talk to those guys and let me go in one of the rooms. And they could put on any little beat that was close to an instrumental and let me just sit there and practice on the mic. This was my sneaky way of getting practice on the mic. Because like I told you, I didn't have a studio. I didn't have any of that. Didn't even really get to know, you know, how I sounded on tape yet, you know. So that was a way for me to first start hearing how I sounded. And then, like, when I first heard myself, I hated it. I ain't gonna lie, I hated it. I was like, that doesn't even sound like me. Like, what the hell? What the? So I had to learn how to adjust my voice on tape. I had to learn the difference between talking from the stomach, velocity, talking from, you know, coming from the neck. So there was a lot of things I knew that I had to learn. And Jermaine did music. One of the guys that worked with Jermaine did music. And he was really into making his little beats and stuff like that. So me and him clicked. We started doing music and stuff together. Clint, on the other hand, didn't do music, but he was really savvy about what was going on in the scene, like the Hollywood scene and all of that. And he knew dancers. So, of course, me and these two guys were really freaking frack for a minute. Clint is the first person who took me out, and I got to get a taste of LA and Hollywood and the nightlife and all that time. And it was bananas. It was super bananas. Like, he took me to places like Funk Jungle, The Palace, Florentine Gardens, you name it. I mean, these were places that were super huge at this time in Hollywood scene. There was a lot of hip hop going on every night of the week. So if you were a teeny bop, you could pretty from Monday to Friday just keep it popping. Just spend a night, wake up, go to sleep, wash your ass, and then get out into the club again and go and do it again. And I was just out there just to dance, man, and just to network and to kind of get people to know who I was. And, you know, I'm from this little small town and all of that, trying to get myself known. And that's how I was able to kind of get in the mix of the dancing scene and meet a lot of the dancers that I'm really friends with now, and got a lot of brothers and sisters in the dancing world. But one opportunity that it led me to, which you will never believe, and if you remember in the first episode, I told you what was one of the first things that influenced me watching was Soul Train. Well, one of the nights we went out, me and Clint met the dance recruiter from Soul Train, my old mentor and good friend today, Eric Cassin. And Eric was passing out tickets for the show Soul Train. Can you believe that? What? So now you already know the backstory. You imagine if I knew this guy was giving out Soul Train tickets, right? So I was like, yo, hold up. Wow. And I saw him give out tickets to certain people and kind of keep it moving. So I had to rush him. Like, yo, excuse me. What are you giving out? He's like, yeah, these are tickets for Soul Train. I was like, oh, sir, I got to have one of those. I'm not even from here. My name is Tony Laurie. Really? This is a true story. And Eric will tell you. He'll tell you. He's laughing. So he was like, let me see what you dance like. I cut a step right there on the spot. He was like, okay, I like what you got. You seem pretty cool. Gave me a ticket. And I was like, well, can I get one for my friend? See, this is me always trying to look out for my boys. I guess that's that tourist thing in me. So can I get one for my friend? So he gave one for my boy Clint, too, even though Clint wasn't even the best dancer. All right, but I needed a ride. Shh. Anyway, so me and my boy Clint got these dance passes for this iconic show, Soul Train. And it was really crazy. It was a great experience there as well. Yes, I was very privy to dancing on the stage and on the risers and all that. Yes, you can look me up and probably find me on some of these episodes and all of that kind of jazz. Very long story there. But I'll get into that another time. I just wanted to share this part of the backstory to you so that way you can kind of see what was my evolution before until I came here to California as far as an entertainer. And the Soul Train show was very pivotal for me because I danced on the show for about 3 seasons. So from about into 1990 when I got here to about 93, about the beginning of 93. So about 2-3 years or so. That's about how long I was on the show. Great experience. And there's some stories there as well that I'll share with you at another time. But right now, I'm going to let you go and let you simmer on what I've shared with you so far about me. So that way you can kind of, you know, let your head kind of not explode. All right. I thank you so much for tuning into this second episode of the Tony Laurie Podcast. Please share with a friend if you have the ability to do that. And if you feel so composed, please leave some comments and some feedback. Okay. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next time. All right. Tony Laurie Podcast. Have a great day.